You are listening to The Nature of Things on WRVO. This essay originally aired on December 11th, 1992.
It's that time of the year when many a nature lover puts his camouflage suit in the closet, his hiking shoes in the basement, and his field guide on the shelf, his or hers, that is. There's snow on the ground, a prophetic nip in the air, and perhaps a half dozen favorite pastimes that have been waiting patiently for this time of indoor leisure. I've often suggested the folly of this approach, cataloging the beauty and the excitement of a winter nature watching, and it's true that my winter excursions are hardly the solitary exercises they once were. Depending on where I go, I may be lapped by cross-country skiers, snowmobilers, or on occasion even snowshoers whose devotion to energetic exercise exceeds mine. I mosey along, occasionally even abandoning the snowshoes to probe an intriguing tight spot. What this leisure peripatetic style of travel reveals has been amply documented on previous episodes of The Nature of Things. And so has the implications of these isolated events when placed on the whole fabric of a winter day. The early pioneer, I suspect, was not much more prone to sally forth in winter than is today's stay-at-home. The men of the 18th and 19th centuries found more necessity for winter excursions, but I have read in journals of that time celebrations of the fact that the supply of wood was at hand, ample food was stashed away, and there was no need to sally forth except to care for the livestock. What the pioneer family gained from all of this propinquity was an accumulating dose of cabin fever, a malaise akin to aggravated boredom. But according to some medicinal historians, possessing overtones of dietary deficiency and sunlight deprivation. Something akin to cabin fever affected even those whose profession or lifestyle demanded that they be outside in every season. A few famous wanderers, who often made their bed and board wherever they could, have invested these ad hoc winter lodgings with a dire atmosphere, unknown to the summertime. Audubon told several dramatic stories of his winter wandering, when he was more or less on the land. It was a time to sleep with gun in one hand and the other hand on the wallet or the poke. We can be forgiven for believing that these forbidding episodes were simply the expressions of the winter blahs in people for whom violence was a way of life. Are there parallel examples of winter depression in the wild? An intriguing question, and one for which I know no answer. Many creatures show a propensity for deep sleep in winter, not quite hibernation, but certainly energy-saving behavior. I've always presumed that explained these extended sleep-ins, but now that I think of it, extended sleeps in winter may be the natural thing, more pituitary reaction than planned behavior. Still, if we're considering the blahs and cabin fever in the wild, we need to consider some other classic winter behavior patterns. We presume that the aftermath of the winter solstice, the period of expanding day length following the shortest day of the year, as an awakening of the estrus. The horned owl begins his courtship talk soon after Christmas, and the dog fox follows hard on his heels, searching the countryside for connubiality. Next, it's the skunk and the woodchuck, and soon after, the plants begin to take notice. By late February, still in the heart of winter, by many standards, the maple tree is ready for a botanical expression of cabin fever release. Looked at objectively, all of these unusual wintertime activities in the wild are necessary, a fulfillment of the age-old timetable of replenishment. Mammals with gestation periods ranging from 45 to 65 days, depending on the species, need to get about the preliminaries early if they want to meet the schedule of April or May delivery. The same with owl or other avian predator. The perfect time for the proliferation of plant eaters is when the great pulse of May and June swells with greenery. The perfect time for the mammal eaters to explode is when this great tide of rodents, lagomorphs, and avian nestlings ventures forth from nest and den. It's my belief that the wild world has no time for winter blahs and fevers. They seem to be a psychological superstructure which humankind has imposed on itself as it becomes more and more isolated from the land. Well, that's all I have for today. This is John Weeks saying thanks for listening. Tune in next week and keep it natural.